Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM this April 12th, 2016 edition. Episode 85 of Nature Bats Last comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico. Our thanks to Afrozin for his theme song contribution. As always, you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. This is a call-in show, so please prepare your questions and get ready to give us a call toll-free at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. We are joined today by our guest, Professor Steve Iliardi.
Wait, and also by a live studio audience.
Live studio audience. Yeah.
That wasn't just me and Mike.
Sorry. We are joined today by Professor Steve Iliardi, who earned his PhD in clinical psychology from Duke University in 1995 and has since served on the faculties of the University of Colorado and presently the University of Kansas. The author of over 50 scholarly articles on mental illness, Dr. Iliardi is a nationally recognized expert on depression. His work has been honored by the American Psychological Association's prestigious Blau Award for early career contributions to the field, and his research on the neuroscience of depression has been funded by the National Institutes of Mental Health. He has also been invited to give two recent TEDx talks on his work and is the author of The Depression Cure, the six-step program to beat depression without drugs. Dr. Iliardi has also received several major teaching awards in recognition of his engaging classroom presence. Recently, he was selected from a pool of over 2,000 instructors at KU as a recipient of the school's highest instructional honor, the HOPE Award for Teaching Excellence. He also maintains a clinical practice and has treated several hundred depressed patients over the course of his career. Dr. Iliardi lives in Lawrence, Kansas, with his wife, Maria, and daughter, Abby. Welcome to Nature Bats Last, Steve.
Hey, thanks so much for having me and for that very flowery introduction. I'm honored to be with you.
Oh, thank you. The reason you're really on the show is we loved your TED Talk, the one titled Depression is the Disease of Civilization. And in the past, we've had clinical psychologists on before, but questioning actual civilization was really never considered by them. And the very essence of this show is challenging civilization and pointing out its devastating impacts on all levels and facets of life, and not just human life we're talking here. So let's begin with your statement about depression being a global epidemic. Maybe you can give us a little bit of insight about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, let's just start with the basics, and the most obvious thing is that the word depression, and I think I mentioned this in my TED Talk, it's a tragically misunderstood term, because people use the word depression in everyday conversation. It's in casual speech, it just means basically sadness. And so a lot of times when people hear that someone is battling what we think of in the business as clinical depression, they don't understand. They just think, oh, well, wait, so are you saying you're sad, you're down, something bad happened, oh, well, come on, let's help you snap out of it. And what they don't realize is that the word depression is shorthand in the clinical world for a devastating illness. So the technical term in our diagnostic manual is major depressive disorder. And so that depression, we're talking about a syndrome that profoundly affects functioning of the brain, profoundly affects the body's ability to regulate arousal level, energy level, hormone levels, sleep architecture. The person loses their ability to focus, their ability to function in most respects. And so this illness, clinical depression, now afflicts at least one in every four Americans at some point in their life. And left untreated, it actually causes brain damage. It causes shrinkage of key circuits in the brain involved in memory and higher reasoning, and it is now the single leading cause of disability for all Americans under the age of 45.
So do people also confuse it with grief?
Yeah, it's a great question. One of the things that really got me started on this whole line of research over the past decade of thinking of depression as a disease of civilization was a discovery by a Western anthropologist. His name is Edward Schieffelin. And Schieffelin spent a decade among the Kaluli people of Papua New Guinea. And the Kaluli are a modern-day Aboriginal group. And they are split into several different bands, like many hunter-gatherers and folks that make their living the way our ancestors did for a long time. They live in really small communities, but that are interrelated and intermarried. There are about 2,000 total. And Schieffelin interviewed every single member of the broader Kaluli people, looking to see their rates of mental illness according to Western criteria. And what he found was only one out of 2,000, which is a rate of depression that is about 1%, about 1 in 100 times as common as it is in the U.S. And what he was really intrigued by, of course, is the question of, well, wait a minute. You know, they have pretty hard lives. Don't they grieve? Don't they have bereavement? Don't they? And the answer is yes, of course. That's part of the human condition. So all of us as human beings are hardwired with circuitry that causes us to feel extreme sadness, extreme emotional pain and loss when we lose someone that's close to us. But the difference between the Kaluli and the rest of us is that when they're grieving, A, there's a really clear trigger, and B, it is time limited. And in fact, we could learn a lot from them because, you know, they when they're grieving a loved one, they do it communally and they do it intensely, and they have rituals that help really jumpstart the healing process. And a lot of us really don't have those same kinds of rituals, I think, in 21st century American life. I guess the bottom line is, as a clinician, grieving is a healthy process that we need to get through when we lose someone. It's a signal to us that we've lost something of value. That's not what we mean by clinical depression.
Right. Well, it seems to me that this entire culture doesn't deal with, in fact, denies grief as a process, and we certainly don't embrace it as a community. We're frequently told things like, especially children, go to your room, deal with that on your own. If you're sad, we don't want to see it. You know, children are not to be heard when it comes to grief, and neither are adults for that matter. So I think you're right that our civilization discourages us from having conversations about things like grief and grieving and death and dying, and we won't even mention bodily functions because, you know, we don't mention bodily functions.
Well, I think that's a really interesting insight that, you know, in modern American life, there's kind of a feeling that we have conquered nature, we've conquered the whole problem of disease, and in essence, almost by extrapolation, conquered the problem of death, and so we don't want to see it. And we don't want to think about it. We don't want to talk about it. When it afflicts us, we take a pause in our regular programming, and we say, "Okay, well, we will attempt to have some sort of recognition that we've just lost someone." But there's very little in the way of, you know, what I think all of our ancestors would have regarded as a normal kind of human reaction of just, you know, allowing ourselves in the company of the people that matter to us the most, allowing ourselves to truly feel the emotional impact of that loss and to express it with, you know, really heartfelt and intense demonstrations of affection for the departed. And, you know, there are still some communities in this country that little pockets, I mean, you know, that still have mm-hmm. those traditions. I think very often in our I think so often in our eagerness to maybe embrace the future, we let go of some of the wisdom of the past that really could still inform us. And by the way, I just want to make really clear to both of you and to your listeners, I'm not a Luddite. I'm not, you know, trying to say that, oh, we should go back and mine the past for everything and forget about everything that we've learned up to the present. I'm not a big fan of letting go of modernity in its entirety, but I do think that things are so far out of balance right now that we need to really return to the past in some key ways when it comes to our mental health.
Yeah, you mentioned the word normal, and it seems to me, in at least the civilization I'm living in currently, it seems anything but normal. I live in a very rural area. I would say somewhat on the fringe or the edge of what would be a traditional life. And when I go back to visit my parents who live in a major city, Phoenix, Arizona, I feel just the different vibration of going to that particular city. And I thought when I left that city that I was somewhat okay. But then when I came to live in a life that was what I consider to be a little more peaceful, I found that I was really high strung. And when I go back... it seems to return very quickly.
And everybody else there seems really high strung.
Yeah, they seem really high strung. And what's interesting, in your TED Talk, you talk about the mismatch between genes we carry, the bodies and brains they are building, and the world we find ourselves in. And we've had other people on the show, including Mary Pfeiffer and Michael Dowd, mention similar things. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this mismatch and its impact.
Absolutely. Well, I think... for me as a clinician, one of the places to start, maybe the best place to start, is with our stress response, the body and brain's, it's often known as the fight or flight response. And we're all familiar with it, with that big adrenaline rush when we face some sort of acute stressor. The thing that I think a lot of people don't realize is that fight or flight response was designed to go off rarely and designed to go off only in situations where we need vigorous muscular activity to respond to some acute threat or danger that's very physical. For our ancestors, it was always a very physical threat that required physical activity. And so the fight or flight response is a really costly reaction. I mean, it involves the release of some really sort of metabolically expensive hormones and lots of energy expenditure. But for our ancestors, when it went off, it was maybe a matter of minutes, right, or possibly a couple of hours. It was a response to maybe some sort of predatory species or some sort of hostile group of other people that may have wanted something that we had or, you know, vice versa, or maybe some natural threat, you know, maybe getting caught in a lightning storm or something. But it is designed only to be a very brief occasional response. The problem with modern life is that it seems almost perversely designed to trigger that fight-or-flight reaction chronically. And unfortunately, so many Americans have chronically elevated levels of stress hormones like cortisol and adrenaline and other corticosteroids. And, you know, it takes a hugely toxic toll on the body, and we now understand a toxic toll on the brain. And here's a point, just if I can bring it around full circle. Clinical depression is ultimately triggered and driven and maintained by the brain's runaway stress response that just won't shut down. And eventually it causes the brain and the rest of the body to shut down as if we're physically ill. Well, I was just going to follow that up with the point that modern life is in some ways almost perversely designed to cause people not only to be perpetually stressed with this 24/7, 365 pace of living that's wildly mismatched with the world that our genes are really expecting us to be inhabiting, but it's perversely designed to cause this epidemic of clinical depression, of insomnia, of anxiety disorders, eventually, as people live long enough, of dementing illness, because this chronic stress response is really hard on the brain. And when you have elevated cortisol over years and years and years, it actually starts to degrade brain tissues and causes some very, very unfortunate reactions in the brain that are now linked to dementing illness like Alzheimer's.
Right. So let's, with that being said, let's talk about some of the strategies you mentioned in your talk as far as dealing with this.
Sure.
Because it's pretty apparent that we can't step outside of civilization, right? That we're sort of trapped in this cage, and certainly in mass, we're not only are we incapable of doing it, but I don't think 1% of the population would be willing, even if they were capable.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that being said, and people don't even know what they're in. I think people are confusing. It seems to me, Steve, people are confusing civilization and life itself. Like, this is how life works.
Right.
Well, I think that's a great point. And I think there are ways, what's been really gratifying for me as a clinician, as a researcher, and as someone who speaks with the public, once I started talking with people about framing clinical depression as a disease of civilization, which means a disease of lifestyle, I really expected a lot of pushback. I expected it not to be a well-received sort of message, but I mean, the reaction has been quite the opposite. When I give people, here's one of my signature lines. You and I were never designed for the sedentary, socially isolated, fast food-laden, sleep-deprived, frenetic 24/7, 365 pace of modern life. And when people hear that, all over the room, you can just see everyone nodding and saying, yes, of course, we feel it deep in our bones. You know, there is something about the way we're living that is crazy and unhealthy and toxic. And then, of course, it raises the question, so what do we do about it? And that's been part of what's been so gratifying with my clinical research team over the past several years, is being able to just, as researchers, what do? We comb through the literature. We comb through the mountains of available evidence on what helps put the brakes on that stress response. And it turns out there are several really doable, modifiable strategies, things that we can incorporate, basically reach one hand back into the past and pull these things right into and weave them into the fabric of our present lives. And so we can talk about, I mean, we have a program that we've developed that it really focuses on six major areas of very simple, modifiable lifestyle strategies. And each of them, it turns out, has overwhelming evidence of having antidepressant effects, of being able to change the brain. You know, a lot of times people think, oh, well, if depression is a brain disease, if it's a chemical imbalance, then, you know, the only way to fix it is to turn to big pharma and say, you know, what chemicals are there out there that we can ingest that you can sell us to fix our chemical imbalance? And by the way, that sounds very snarky and very anti-med, and there certainly are people that have been helped by antidepressant medications, but they haven't proven to be nearly as effective as any of us would have hoped. And it turns out there are so many different ways that we can change neurological signaling, and most of them have nothing whatsoever to do with swallowing chemicals.
Right. I mean, in one of them you talk about is physical activity, and what I found interesting because you talked about the Kaluli and about exercise, and they don't exercise. They said they live. And we talk a great deal on this show about the difference between making a living and living. And that seems to be another a point of confusion in our lifestyle, is that we are not actually living in some cases. We're too busy trying to make a living.
Yeah, we partition everything. Yeah. So you want to exercise, you do that after work.
Right.
Right.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
Maybe go to the gym
and then,
on the way home.
Well, and
right.
Then we wonder,
can you talk a little bit about that?
And we wonder why so many people, I mean, you know, it's really funny talking to, if you've ever talked to the owner of a fitness club or a gym, you know, they say that they get this huge surge of new memberships in early January. All the people that have made their New Year's resolution, it's like, oh, I'm finally going to start exercising, I'm going to get fit, I'm going to start exercising. And by mid-February, the club is empty. And the overwhelming majority of people that have made these resolutions, they find they can't do it. Why? Because we're not designed to exercise. We're designed to be active in the service of meaningful goals. So the average visitor to Walt Disney World, according to the Disney people, they walk up 9 miles per day.
Yeah.
Not because they're particularly fit human specimens, quite the opposite, but just because
hey, it's tough dressing like Mickey.
Yeah, I know, yeah, but I mean, seriously, it's they are active because they want to be. And not because they want to be active, but because they want to do stuff that requires activity. And that's the same with the Kaluli. It's the same with any contemporary group that has a lifestyle that requires them to be active in the service of meaningful goals. But if you go to a hunter-gatherer group and give them any modern convenience that allows them to have a shortcut where they can be less active, they adopt it eagerly. So we do have wiring, I believe, in our brains that says basically, be lazy whenever you can, save energy. But that programming was really useful for our ancestors, right? Because, I mean, why expend calories needlessly? I mean, none of our ancestors was ever lacing up their sandals and going for a 10K just for the hell of it, right? I mean, nobody ever exercised, but they, you know, they were physically active because life rewarded that. Life in some ways demanded that. And so we need to be clever about building meaningful physical activity into our lives, I think, in the present.
So I was pulling weeds this morning. It didn't feel all that meaningful. And I would have gladly handed that over to somebody else.
I ran 10K, Steve, so.
Well, there you go. Right. Now, some of us, of course, are lucky enough that we can make regular activity a habit, essentially. And, you know, there's an interesting neuroscience finding that any activity that becomes a habit, once you've done it about 20 times or so, it becomes self-reinforcing. So think about flossing your teeth. It's, you know, very unnatural activity, not intrinsically terribly enjoyable to floss. But believe it or not, once it becomes a habit, you pull the floss out of the container, start, you know, wrapping it around your fingers and putting it up in your teeth, and there's a little surge of dopamine-based signaling in the reward circuits that says, oh, this is good. You should be doing more of that. That's what we do. That's a habit. Mm-hmm. And that can occur with exercise. There's no question. I mean, I do actually try to exercise just about every day. But I try to do it in ways that really work with my brain's programming. So a lot of it will be social. A lot of it will be game-like. A lot of it will be, you know, meaningful in some sort of way. I hope that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You talked earlier about receiving very little pushback. And I got to tell you, we've had very few people on this show who have what I would call real jobs that talk about civilization at all. First of all, even recognize civilization as being something different than capitalism or life in general. And you not only do that, but you talk about it as being detrimental to our health. And the fact that you don't receive or you've received very little pushback, Guy and I looked at each other in shock because we talk about these things all the time on this show. We both speak publicly. Guy's written books.
And a typical response right. is, so you expect me to go back to sucking guts out of bugs and living in caves?
Right, right.
So, well, right. Go ahead.
I mean, you must be really good at what you do because well, we're just terrible at it. Because literally, people, when we bring up the idea of civilization and questioning anything about it in most groups, unless they're just people who have followed our work, we get that look of like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, I think a lot of it, I totally get that, by the way. And I think maybe a lot of it is that I get to fly under the radar a little bit, right? Because I'm coming at it from the angle of, here is obvious human suffering. You know, people with depression are suffering to such an extent that 40,000 of them end their own lives in this country every year. You know, there are over 1 million suicides globally every year. The vast majority of them are due to clinical depression and the suffering that it brings. And so that gets people's attention, and it takes them to a place of compassion and curiosity about, well, what's driving it? What's causing it? How can we fix it? And what I'm prescribing as a solution, of course, like I said, it's not a Luddite solution. It's not Ted Kaczynski out in a cabin in Montana saying, you know, we need to overthrow the entire system and start over from scratch and get up completely off the grid. It's saying, let's be smart about this. let's just look reality in the face and see all the things that we're doing that are harming us and that are crazy, and let's see if there's some way that we can try to have some of the best of both worlds, right? In other words, let's at least vis-a-vis this epidemic of mental illness, let's see what we need to reclaim from the past without necessarily sacrificing the very best things of the present.
Yeah. Or, I mean, or the way we kind of bring it up to people, and this doesn't necessarily go over well either, Stephen. I'm not suggesting it. But we generally look at it, there is no going back. I don't have, A, the skill set to go back, and B,
exactly.
It's not the same planet, and C, there's 7 billion of us.
Right.
And so we're in what we call a predicament. And the predicament is we have to adapt and come up, like you've done, with strategies to live in civilization, which in some ways shows the insanity of it to me, because we really, if something's harming us, we generally get rid of that thing, but we can't get rid of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to adapt and cope with strategies and how to live with it is kind of the way I'm, and I think Guy, kind of look at it.
Yeah.
I love that. I really like the way you framed it. And you know, the other thing that I really like about it is that you're not being overly romantic. I mean, you're not romanticizing the past, which I think is really easy for us to do. And I have to sometimes, you know, give that caveat when I'm giving a talk, because people think like, oh, I want to go be a hunter-gatherer. And, you know, or people will ask me, like, do you ever think about, like, and I say, no, absolutely not. It's a really hard way of making a living. And just as there are diseases of civilization, diseases that are endemic throughout the developed, westernized, industrialized world, I mean, not just depression, but atherosclerosis and asthma and allergies and many forms of cancer and hemorrhoids and tooth decay, I mean, you name it. But there are endemic diseases of Aboriginal groups as well. And their life expectancy generally is quite a bit shorter. They have much higher rates of infant mortality. They have parasitic illness that they deal with, and the burden of parasites for many of them is outrageously high. And so, you know, as long as we don't romanticize the past, but look at both past and present and hopefully future with really clear eyes and say, okay, like you said, what is our predicament? And what is the most meaningful set of things that we need to change that might give us a better future or a better present, you know, if that means the 70 million Americans that are going to be struck down with depressive illness at some point, that, you know, we've had a 300% increase in antidepressant medication use in this country just since 1990.
Right.
But it hasn't made a dent in the epidemic. I mean, the rates of depressive illness are just as high as they ever were. And in fact, there's several signals that suggest a bit higher now, and going up among young people. So, you know, we clearly haven't solved the problem yet, but I do believe that there's a way to do it.
I often wonder if, given the choice between, you know, high rates of infant mortality and parasitic infection and violent death, but yet not being clinically depressed, or being clinically depressed and having cell phones and having a job and having air conditioning, I wonder what the choice would be, what choice we would make. if, you know, not knowing either and not experiencing either, that's an interesting, you know,
absolutely. I love where you're going with that. And, you know, the fact of the matter is we really can't fully know. Right. There's no way to meaningfully undo and unlearn everything we've acclimated to. But my sense of it is, and you know, I could be completely wrong. My sense of it is that if we can live in our current civilization really wisely, and if we happen to be a little bit lucky, there's a way that we can at least approximate the best of both worlds and have a very good life, and maybe build a better life for the people that come after. Then again, I'm an optimist.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I just said, you know, I am a natural optimist. I'll own that. You know, I can sit in a room with 10 individuals who are severely depressed and in incredible pain and suicidal, and part of my training is I go to a spot where, you know, I am envisioning what they're going to look like, not right now, but in 3 months, as they begin to take steps to get well, and most of them do get well. And, you know, so I think part of the sort of temperament that it takes to be effective with other individuals who are in pain is to not dwell on what's wrong, but to dwell on how can we make this better, and what is it going to look like after those things happen.
You're listening to Nature Bites Last on the Progressive Radio Network. We're joined today by clinical psychologist and professor Steve Ilardi from the University of Kansas. Steve, I was recently featured in an episode of National Geographic Explorer with Bill Nye, and the entire episode was wrapped around the five stages of grief. It started with Arnold Schwarzenegger as the therapist for Bill Nye, pointing out that he's in denial about his climate grief, and that we had to work through these five stages of grief. Can you draw some analogs between your work and dealing with climate change, depression, or whatever you want to call those negative sentiments that you get when you think about abrupt climate change and where we're headed?
Well, yeah, I like the question. I would say that people who focus on climate change, all of us, and you know, I'm certainly in this category. It can feel overwhelming. It's going to be stressful. It will elevate our stress response. And one of the big triggers for depression, and something we talk a lot about in our protocol, is a cognitive process that we, in the business, we call it rumination, which is just a fancy term for dwelling repeatedly on negative information. And people, when they're depressed or even when they're clinically anxious, they spend a lot of time in their heads. They spend a lot of time just sort of rehearsing over and over again, you know, this is what happened, this is bad, this is horrible, here are all the things that are going to ensue that are going to make it even worse. And what we find is when people get caught in their heads like that and ruminate, it actually amplifies the intensity of their negative emotions, and it amplifies the response of the brain's stress response circuitry. So it turned out to be pretty psychologically toxic and even physiologically toxic.
I appreciate that you're not mentioning my name. Thank you for that.
Or mine.
So here's the deal. How do you break rumination? How do you interrupt it? What's the healthy response? What's the adaptive response? It turns out to be activity, meaningful activity, that we can take that ruminative response and that stress response and all the energy that it gives us if we're able to channel it in the direction of some sort of meaningful activity. It actually then interrupts the ruminative cycle, and it, instead of getting us caught in our heads, it gets us out into the world of activity and other people, shared experience, and that's what I believe we're designed for. And so, you know, if it's concern about global warming, which I think is probably maybe the single biggest thing people should be concerned about right now, if that concern gets them caught in their head and just sitting around ruminating and moping, then obviously it's going to be maladaptive. But if it can be harnessed to get people active and in community with others who are kindred spirits and like-minded, well, then I think it can actually, in a really bizarre, counterintuitive way, can be antidepressant in its impact.
Absolutely. That's why I go running. It gets me out of my head.
Absolutely. Well,
and community activities here are very important, I think, to all of us. Witness the fact that we have a live studio audience.
Right.
and these same people are at potluck essentially every Sunday evening and interacting with each other on a community basis.
Yeah,
which is critical because, I mean, honestly, I believe that all of us crave deep down a connection to a group that's something bigger than ourselves. You know, for hundreds of thousands of years, our survival as individuals critically hinged on the survival of our group. And there was no individual life without the life of that group. And these were the, I mean, imagine going through life on a 70-year camping trip with the 30 to 50 people that mean the most to you. And that's what life was. And, you know, I think we crave that sense of belonging. And without it, we're so much more vulnerable to mental illness.
Yeah, it seems to me, at least since I've, you know, I left my teaching career in 2011, and I thought I knew what community was because I lived in a neighborhood, or different neighborhoods, my entire life. And it seemed that once I came to a place where there was actual community and people doing things, not just, you know, going to their mailbox and waving at one another each day or going to a HOA meeting or something like that, something dawned on me that I had clearly been missing for the first 40-some years of my life. And for me, because I talk about climate change and I talk about ecocide and I talk about social justice issues all the time, it could become overwhelming and I could end up in a fetal position in my closet. But
Not that you haven't done that.
Right. But I live in a community that's actually communal and that has somewhat carried me to a place that I'm able to, you know, function daily. I think that seems to be missing. It doesn't seem like we have a sense of community in a lot of our lives.
Well, I think this is an important distinction. Aristotle defined friendship differently than, say, drinking buddies, mm-hmm. right? So drinking buddies get together, they watch the football game, they're together every weekend, they spend a lot of time together, and maybe they have things in common and maybe they don't. But Aristotle defined friendship as an interaction between people who are working together toward the common good.
Yeah.
And so that working together part is important and the common good. So I think of the folks that we have in this room and that are in living in community and working together and interacting together, not just drinking buddies. I think that's a clear distinction.
Yeah, and so social connection is one of your strategies, right?
It is one of our six core. And in fact, it's absolutely no accident that we developed the treatment to be administered in a group format. Because in the group now you have, I mean, think about what depression basically gives the brain a signal to pull away from everybody. Kind of like when we have the flu, right? So if you have a 102 fever, you don't want to be around people. You don't want to socialize. You want to be alone and you want to shut down. When people are clinically depressed, they're getting that same sort of signal in the brain that's saying pull away from everybody and shut down, be by yourself. And it turns out to be the very worst thing that they can do. And so a big emphasis in our treatment program is a sense of, no, you need to be connected. We're designed to be connected with others. And the worst thing in the world we can do is be isolated. And yet, as you guys have said, we live in a society that pushes people toward more superficial connection rather than deep, meaningful connection. And I love that invocation of Aristotle, that idea of working side by side toward a meaningful goal. I'll tell you one of the most interesting things is I've had a couple of patients that served in the military and saw tours of duty in combat zones with a platoon, with guys that they had a shared destiny and they had a shared mission and a shared sense of purpose. And whatever we think about combat and, you know, whatever their mission was, they come back and they very often say that was the only time in my life when I felt truly connected and when I felt like I was truly on a mission that mattered. Not because of the mission of, you know, hurting other people or having an out-group or any of that, but rather that they were part of something bigger than themselves and connected to guys where, you know, if I don't have your back, then you're going to die. And if you don't have mine, I'm going to die. We're in this together. And that really struck me that, you know, I mean, war is hell, and yet they could come back from hell and say that was when they felt most connected and most alive.
Right, and there are relatively few positions in modern society where you have that experience. First responders, for example, I was a wildland firefighter for several years, and there's a sense of camaraderie that develops when you're working side by side with people, and you have to have somebody's back, or somebody gets hurt, or worse. So there's just not that many opportunities in contemporary society for us to experience that.
Absolutely. But I think, if we're willing to seek them out, I mean, just like you guys have done, or if we're willing to be a part of building something, you know, building a community where people, you know, genuinely feel like they're with kindred spirits and you know, being side by side really matters. I think there are, you know, again, there are ways if we're willing to think outside the box and not just accept the roles that are handed to us by civilization right now. There's a hunger. I mean, so many people want. I mean, there are people that go to AA meetings that have never had a problem with drinking in their life just because they want to be a part of something bigger.
Right.
Because they want the community.
I think we all feel that. We all sense that we want to be part of something bigger than ourselves, and it's so hard to find in this culture.
Yeah. I mean, this is not a criticism, but, I look through your stress response strategies, and they all seem like very, they seem like common sense things to do, and that we should automatically just kind of be doing because, well, they feel good. But civilization is, I don't know if it's blocked it, deflected it, makes it, you know, impossible to get healthy sleep. you know, these things seem obvious.
Well, I hope so. Yeah, I think no. Many of them are. So I'll say two things about it. I mean, one, yes, many of them, I mean, because they're all built on things that, I mean, that we can learn from Aboriginal groups, from our ancestors. I mean, you know, it's estimated that the rate of depression in the U.S. in the 19th century was probably about 10 times lower than it is now, right? So it's much lower among the Amish today. So, I mean, they should seem pretty obvious and pretty commonsensical and pretty intuitive. Now, there are some elements, though. So let me say two things. One, there are some elements that require a little bit of neuroscientific understanding to really get right. So, for example, on the nutrition side, I mean, there are many elements of the modern diet that turn out to be really depressogenic, to push our brain in a depressive direction. And some of the hacks, some of the short-term fixes, like, for example, omega-3 supplementation, you know, my grandmother didn't know anything about omega-3. She didn't know anything about the anti-inflammatory impact or what sort of dosage you would use or what kind of fish oil product or any other kind of product if you're vegan. I mean, that's a specific kind of hack. Ditto for phototherapy or bright light exposure. I mean, yes, she might have known that it could make you feel better to be out in the sunshine, but she wouldn't have known, you know, for how long and what's the best time of day to reset your circadian phase shifting. And right. So, you know, and oh, what if you happen to live in Kansas where there are stretches in the winter where you're not going to see the sun at all for you know, several days, maybe weeks in a row?
Yeah, I don't know how you do it. There,
right. Well, you know, you buy a light box and, yeah. You know, have an LED panel and, you know, okay, so what kind of box? And, well, you know, what units of intensity? How about 10,000 lux? And, I mean, so there is some real science behind it, right? I mean, it's not just about common sense, but yet it does seem commonsensical. The second thing I would say is many people, when they're clinically depressed, even if they know what they should be doing, they don't have the initiative or the energy to be able to pull it off without some help. And so, you know, in our program, we really try to set our patients up for success. And so when it comes, for example, to physical activity, yeah, they know they should be active, but they can't initiate it because the circuits in their brain that allow them to translate their intentions into action, those circuits go dormant. So they'll sit there and beat themselves up and say, I should, you know, get up and do something. But we hook them up with a trainer, and they've already scheduled their sessions in advance. And for a lot of them, it's just brisk walking is going to be enough to get them into an aerobic zone. So, you know, they're sitting on the couch, and now they get a phone call. Hey, Mrs. Jones, this is Biff, your personal trainer, and just wanted to remind you that we're meeting in a half hour. And now she can do it. She can get up and, you know, even though there's no way in hell she was going to do it on her own.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It makes perfect sense. Are you taking your strategies and your work and are you trying to pass it on to others in your field?
Absolutely, yeah. It's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. You know, I guess really when I wrote it, I was thinking primarily about an audience of people that were battling depression or maybe had a loved one. But I've had so many of my colleagues, and you know, I mean, the really flattering thing is not just in this country, but in several other countries, fellow psychologists, some MD psychiatrists, some social workers, contact me and say, hey, you know, this protocol. In fact, I was just talking to a colleague yesterday from China, at a university in Guangdong, who runs their EAP, Employee Assistance Program, at a university in China, and she knew of this work. And is putting together an adaptation to run with depressed students and faculty there, right in the center of China, which is, you know. So it's, like I said, I think it's an idea that resonates with a lot of folks and, you know, the possibility that they could somehow change how they're living in really doable ways that would make a difference in how their brain is functioning. I think it's a really appealing one for a lot of folks.
Great. So what's next? What's next, and what kind of challenges do you face in your own work?
That's a great question. Well, so I think part of what's next is we're in the process right now of writing up. We finally have completed a randomized controlled trial. where we're trying to get the work published in a leading scientific journal that, you know, we've presented at conferences already. We've disseminated a protocol to colleagues. But, I mean, getting it published in a top-tier journal, that's huge, right, in terms of credibility. Then I would say probably another big step is seeing what other clinical populations this would be meaningful for. It turns out, for example, that bipolar disorder, which I'm sure you guys are familiar with, is also burgeoning in terms of the prevalence rate. I mean, there are estimates that the rate of bipolar illness has more than tripled just over the past few decades. It used to be a very rare condition, and now we're seeing, you know, maybe up to 5% of the population. We believe that many of these same principles could be used in bipolar illness, and that's particularly important because many of the medications used to treat bipolar can be pretty hard on the brain and body. Many people don't tolerate those meds very well. They can be very sedating. They can have some really difficult side effects. So if we could help, especially for folks who suffer from bipolar depression, where the medications often are not particularly good at treating the depression side of bipolar, you know, that would be pretty huge as well. We're also, by the way, always tinkering. You know, it's part of the beauty, I think, of being in the scientific world is, like, you never rest on your laurels. And so we're actually in the process of revising our protocol, adding some elements. There are some things on the nutritional side that we're really excited about. Some have to do, I don't know if you guys have ever talked about the microbiome. Do you guys know that term?
No.
Oh, wow. Do you want to chase down a...
Yeah, we dropped the ball there, Steve. Sorry.
What's that? I missed that. What was that?
We dropped the ball. Sorry.
Oh, no worries. Okay, so just super quick. This is the cutting edge in probably all of medicine, is the discovery that we are not alone, that even in our own bodies, we are outnumbered, enormously outnumbered. Each of our bodies is the host of roughly 100 trillion microbes, and they're not the enemy. Most of the time, they are actually symbiotic. They, you know, it's a win-win. We provide a home and some nutrients for them, and they do all kinds of wonderful things for us. They help us extract nutrients from food. They help with digestion. They help with our immune system, and they have learned how to hack into the brain.
Can
Here's the problem.
What? Sorry, it's a civilization now, question.
Yeah, no. Well, here's a civilization point, and that is, over the last 100 years or so, in our medical advances, and particularly in developing antibiotics, we have devastated the microbial community that should be populating our bodies. Because when a kid has an ear infection and they go on a round of, say, a Z-Pack or something, right? You think, oh, it's just a Z-Pack, they take it 5 days. Well, zithromycin is a type of antibiotic called a macrolide that absolutely devastates the microbes in the digestive tract. And, you know, before long, if you have devastated the natural sort of flora and fauna in your microbiome, then it's not doing its job. And guess what? Part of its job is interfacing with our nervous system to keep things in balance. So what we're now learning is that people who have a depleted microbiome are particularly vulnerable, not only to many forms of illness, but even to many forms of mental illness. And probiotic supplementation, so actually taking supplements that help replenish your microbial community, they've actually been found to have both anti-anxiety and antidepressant benefit. It's a really exciting new frontier.
And just another reason why we call our show Nature Bats Last.
Yes.
Hey, Steve, we really appreciate your time. Was there a place where people can get your book and find out a little bit about more what you're doing?
Absolutely, yeah. So, the book, I guess it's available at most mainstream brick-and-mortar bookshops. It's available online. Amazon, you know, usually has pretty good pricing.
Give us the title one more time.
It's called The Depression Cure, and the subtitle, The Six-Step Program to Beat Depression Without Drugs. If they want to learn more about the protocol itself, they can certainly do so with that book. If there are any clinicians listening that want to get a copy of the protocol, they can contact our lab directly. You can get me through the University of Kansas. Actually, our lab email, it's a Gmail address. It's just TLCDepression, all one word, TLCDepression, at Gmail. My email is my last name, Ilardi, I-L-A-R-D-I, at ku.edu. They can, I've done two TED Talks that you mentioned, but I did like a two-hour talk at a local library that the university was good enough to videotape, where I get to go into much, much more detail about the program and about the rationale and different elements. So if folks want to watch that video, it's pretty easy to find. If you just go on YouTube and type my last name, or type Ilardi depression, it's one of the first things that'll come up.
Excellent. Thank you for your time. One last thing really quickly.
This summer I'm going to be launching a YouTube channel where it'll be ad-free, everything completely free, just public service to put up different little short videos where I go into detail explaining each of these different elements, one little sort of bite-sized piece at a time. So folks can be able to look out for that.
When it comes up, send me the link and I'll post it on our Facebook pages.
Awesome.
That'd be great. Well, thank you, Steve. Yeah, we appreciate your time and your work.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
All right. Thank you. That was Professor Steve Ilardi from Kansas University, also a clinical psychologist. Guy.
We have a climate change update. The latest response to Tim Garrett's excellent work demonstrating that civilization is a heat engine is the response I've come to expect. It's elucidated by a paper in the April 4th, 2016 issue of Nature Climate Change. I'll quote from the abstract. This highlights the importance of maintaining economic growth in a carbon-constrained world and reducing the cost of backstop measures, such as large-scale CO2 removal, in any ambitious consumption-maximizing strategy to limit peak warming, end quote. So only the collapse of civilization prevents Ronald Reagan greenhouse, according to Garrett's abundant published research. But according to this latest paper in Nature Climate Change, economic growth is imperative. As if anybody was serious about questioning the dominant paradigm anyway.
Hooray for us.
Even the United States federal government finally admits in a report dated April 4th, 2016, that climate change is making Americans sick.
Hey, we just talked about that.
Duh. You're right. Specifically, the report concludes, quote, that global warming will make the air dirtier, water more contaminated, and food more tainted. It warned of diseases such as those spread by ticks and mosquitoes, longer allergy seasons, and thousands of heat wave deaths. Environmental Protection Agency Chief Gina McCarthy says, if that's not enough, climate change affects people's mental health, too.
Yeah.
End quote.
You don't say.
We just had this conversation. Hey. Where's the government did this whole time?
Don't fixate on it.
According to a study published April 8th, 2016 in the journal Science Advances, melting ice sheets, especially in Greenland, are changing the distribution of weight on Earth.
Yeah, a wobble or something.
Right. As a result, both the North Pole and the wobble, which is called polar motion, have changed course. The North Pole is on the run. It has taken a sharp turn to the east.
But apparently that's okay. Like, I read this article and they said, not to worry.
I know. I read
nothing,
20 articles.
Nothing bad is going to happen with
it's
that.
It's all going to be fine.
It's fine.
The Earth isn't even rotating like it used to.
We can wobble.
Change. It'll be fine.
We can wobble.
Wobble with me. Climate change projections have vastly underestimated the role that clouds play, meaning future warming could be far worse than is currently projected, according to research published in the April 8, 2016 edition of Science. According to the paper's abstract, quote, global climate model estimates of the equilibrium global mean surface temperature response to a doubling of atmospheric CO2 measured by the equilibrium climate sensitivity, or ECS, range from 2 degrees to 4.6 degrees C. Clouds are among leading causes of this uncertainty. Here we show that the ECS can be up to 1.3 degrees C higher in simulations where mixed phase clouds consisting of ice crystals and supercooled liquid droplets are constrained by global satellite observations. The higher ECS estimates are directly linked to a weakened cloud phase feedback arising from a decreased cloud glaciation rate in a warmer climate.
In other words,
expect the global average temperature to heat up faster than expected.
Oh, thank God. That's simpler.
I should have just said that and misquoted that.
Right.
The summary of another paper in the April 8th, 2016 issue of Science concludes, quote, the climatic changes during the PETM occurred over longer timescales than those of anthropogenic climate change. The impacts of the latter may thus be even more severe, end quote. Regular listeners may recall that the PETM, or Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, included a 5C global average temperature rise during a span of 13 years, according to an October 2013 paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and now we're going faster.
All right. Hey, everything's going to be fine.
Must go faster.
Right. All right. You got a webinar coming up?
I do, but let's talk about that next week.
Okay. Well, that about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Best Last, and Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Best Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show. And please share widely the link and information from this particular show. And continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. You can follow my essay at the Good Men Project every Sunday. We'll see you next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll interview longtime sailor and activist and friend of the show, Kevin Hester from New Zealand. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM or at Stitcher.com and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to our live studio audience. Settle down. Our listeners and Afro's in for his music and our guest, Steve Ilardi. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.